30, and it directs the audit division to estimate its expenses in advance and then charge all state officers, departments, boards, and commissions. With the exception of the state school fund and the trust funds, the division charges each agency based on their share of total state expenditures, revenues, cash, and FTE. It's a formula. We really don't know how much of that is general fund because that's determined by the agencies who pay us, but we did get contact DAS and find out from them that they're using about a 38.4% of their assessment is general fund. So that's, I mean, really without contacting the agencies and asking them, what fund do you pay this out of? That's the best we can give you on that one. Our other assessment, well, the other one really is an assessment. The record center is a fee for the boxes that are stored at the record center, and that's calculated by how many boxes each agency has and then timesing that by a per box price. So right now what I got from our director of archives is that 50% of the fees are from other fund agencies and 50% are from general fund agencies. That doesn't necessarily mean, because some of those agencies are a mix like us, so it could be less or more. But that is on by fee. The other question that you asked us was about the getting an AG opinion about the dissolving of counties. We did talk to the AG, found out that it is the county's responsibility to conduct and vote elections. They are the only ones that can do that by statute. And that the AG did ask us, are you sure you want to pay for this? Because this is a huge question and a huge bill, and it's more than just you. So I am planning on talking to the governor's office and to the AG's office about how we do this together, because I know the governor is collecting information on this, so I need to get fed into that and find out what's going on. So there's that one.
Be kind enough, if and when you're able to get some of this information, to
yes,
get it back to
of
us.
Of course.
I mean,
yes.
Even though we have generously passed out your budget long before, maybe that's available.
Yes. Okay. Yes, because it's a priority to us, too,
well,
to figure this out.
Yeah. It's a major issue that we would prefer the states prepared to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully they'll never have to, but prepared if they do have to.
Right.
Okay.
Then the second bit of information is a white paper on the HTML ballot process. And I won't go through that. You guys can read that if you're interested, but you did ask that, so we brought that to you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Very nice.
And that will be it for me.
Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Okay, good morning. For the record, Bill Bradbury, Oregon Secretary of State. And with your permission, I'll introduce our state archivist and move further forward on the budget. Our state archivist is Mary Beth Herkert, and it's fairly remarkable. She's worked at the Archives Division for 22 years. She started as a processing archivist, which maybe she will tell you what that is. I'm mystified. But,
I thought there was a law in this state about child labor.
Right on. Well, you know, the Archives Division. And she's worked her way through the ranks and is now the state archivist. And I think it's important for you to know that she is currently the president of the National Association of Government Archives and Records Administrators, which is known as NAGRA. NAGARA, excuse me, not NAGRA, it's NAGARA. Mary Beth is also a certified records manager, which is an international certification for the records management profession. So...
thank you.
With that, pleasure to introduce Mary Beth.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Jensen and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Beth Herkert, and I'm the director of the Archives Division. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to present the Archives Division budget proposal for 2007-2009. And I'll start with our budget drivers, and the first of those is our staff and customer base. The Archives Division has 22 full-time employees representing four program areas: administration, records management, reference, and publications. These program areas provide a wide variety of service to a very diverse customer base made up of the general public, elected officials, private sector businesses, and over 3,000 state agencies and political subdivisions. These customers have come to expect the Archives Division staff to provide information and perform services at a very high level. So our reference unit is expected to make the permanently valuable records of Oregon available to them via the web, in person, by mail, or over the phone, so that they can trace their family's roots, establish a property line, determine the intent of a particular law or statute, or look to see how a particular event in history affects Oregonians. The Records Management Unit provides state agencies and political subdivisions with advice and assistance on a variety of public records issues and write retention and disposition schedules, helping to ensure that these agencies manage their public records in the most effective and efficient ways possible. In addition, our customers also rely on records managers to interpret and explain new laws and federal mandates, such as the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, or the laws on civil procedure, and how they affect their records-keeping practices and ultimate disposition. The unit also operates the State Record Center, which literally saves the states hundreds of thousands of dollars by offering inexpensive storage for public records until they are ready to be destroyed. The Security Copy Depository provides state agencies and political subdivisions with environmentally controlled storage for microfilm, ensuring that the records with long-term or permanent retention will be preserved regardless of the format that they are used to be created in. The Publications Unit receives and publishes administrative rules from state agencies and boards and commissions. Any changes to the administrative rules are published monthly and annually compiled both online and in paper, ensuring that agency and citizens alike have access to the most current rules. In addition, this unit is also responsible for publishing the Oregon Blue Book. And again, this publication is also printed in both paper and then online. And in fact, the printed version for this year's Blue Book will be arriving at the Archives Division tomorrow. The online version is ever expanding and increasingly popular because it's very efficient and very easily accessed, and it's been online since February. So the new Blue Book has been online since February. Our customers have come.
Sorry, when you say February, do you mean of 06 or?
07.
07, okay.
The new Blue Book was.
Oh, the new Blue Book.
The 07-09 Blue Book is up.
But the Blue Books have, how long have the Blue Books in general been online?
Chair Jensen and Representative Beyer, I think they've been online since 1999. I think that was the first Blue Book that went online.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Mr.
Fine.
So our customers have come to expect more, and we have to try to deliver more. And our second budget driver is technology. And in order to provide more services to our customers, the Archives Division has embraced technology early on and often. As the first archives in the world on the World Wide Web, it is only fitting that the Archives Division has the most web pages in the state. These pages are used to provide reference services and exhibit our holdings. The most recent online exhibit focuses on the Oregonians' experiences from pre-war through post-World War II. As with any exhibit, it is very colorful and full of information. But what makes this exhibit unique is its size. It's well over 400 pages and presents the user with the ability to view the actual records that we have in our holdings relating to this event. We have letters from Governor Sprague, the Defense Council, and a state library, just to mention a few. And they're all available with the click of the mouse to view online. And in addition, what this exhibit did, and it shows how we use technology, is we have linked to different film clips, such as ones depicting the bombing of Pearl Harbor, and an actual audio clip of Adolf Hitler that are held in other repositories, so that everybody gets the most complete experience when they view this exhibit online. Most importantly, this exhibit doesn't sanitize the events that took place, such as the internment of Japanese Americans, but because we used the original record to show the history, you get the history, warts and all. We have had much positive feedback from this and from those who have viewed the exhibit, including teachers who have now made this part of their classrooms. Web-based training has also been a mainstay on our website since 2001. This type of training allows our records management unit to get training out to agencies that might not otherwise be able to attend workshops in person. Content and quality have not been sacrificed, as these web applications include videos or narrated PowerPoints and interactive quizzes at the end so that the trainee can test what they have just learned. Our most recent application addresses email management for local government. The enhanced online Blue Book with this year's newly expanded kids section is another example of how we've used technology to get more information out to more customers. Again, this section is designed to be a teaching tool with exercises such as quizzes, word matches, and crosswords puzzles geared towards children at a variety of age levels. The publications unit has also developed an online form that allows agencies to file their administrative rule notices online. Our plans for 2007-2009 include implementing an electronic records management system, which will allow the Secretary of State the ability to manage all of their electronic records, including email, in a manner that is systematic and routine. The framework, which has been developing the agency's file structure, has already been completed. It is our hope that once we implement the electronic records management system, every user will literally have to drag and drop to manage their electronic records, and the system will then handle disposition, so we will have an effective records management system for all electronic records. Once we have fully implemented, it is our goal to allow other state agencies and local governments to buy licenses off of our system so that they, too, can manage their electronic records more effectively. We've also begun developing the architecture to create a true digital archives. Not only will you be able to find what we have available, but you will also be able to view and purchase the actual documents related to this information online. We have our Pioneer database, have begun developing that. We currently have 113,000 names in our Pioneer database of individuals who lived or were living in Oregon at or before statehood, and it is our hope to have the records associated with these individuals linked and available online by February 14, 2009. The last of our budget drivers is our building rent. And we pay rent to the Department of Administrative Services for the Archives building. The rent for this building is disproportionately high because we pay office space rent for our entire building, including the stack areas, which are only used for records, for storing records, and not as office space for employees. The general fund amount for rent in 2007-2009 will be approximately $1.2 million. What this means is that when we have to cut general fund dollars, we must hold our rent harmless and cut other general fund dollars, which means cutting our staff, which then directly impacts our ability to continue to provide the services that we are required to provide under statute.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bromo.
Thank you. Mary Beth, you mentioned that DAS is charging you office space rent for the entire building, including the part of the building that would be considered warehouse, which obviously is a lower priced space rent, generally speaking. Why is it that they're charging you office space rent for the entire building instead of splitting it out and having the public area and so on as being office space, and then the rest of the building where the tracks are and basically the warehouse is, charged at warehouse rents?
Chair Jensen, Representative Crummell, that's a good question that we've been asking to ask for a number of years. They basically state to us that the reason they charge us the same is because our stack areas are environmentally controlled. Although the state library, when they did their remodel, also had their stack areas environmentally controlled, and they're not being charged office rent. We don't know. We have not been able to figure that out. And we would love to be able to pay two different rates for the stack area and then office space and public area.
Mr. Chair, could we ask Darren to ask DAS that question and have them get back to us on that.
we could do that.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you very much. Is it because it's always been?
Sure, Jensen, yes, that's it has been that way since we moved into that building.
That's a nice part about government. Very flexible.
Thank you. I guess a follow-up on that is in the memo that we have here, where you talk about how much you're charging for storage. Is that based on what the rent is, or should that be more if the rent is more, I guess?
Chair Jensen, Representative Beyer, the fees that we charge for storage is for the State Record Center, which is a complete different other facility that is located out off of the Salem Parkway, and that's for inactive records that are just waiting for the retention to be met. It's so that we have inexpensive storage for those records.
Okay, I see that now where that's in there. Thank you.
Okay. Performance measures. Our first performance measures relates to administrative rules, and our previous performance measure for that was the publication of 100% of administrative rules electronically and in paper. We've been doing that for quite some time, so we asked for and submitted for approval a new performance measure, which allows us to track the number of rule notices filed electronically versus those filed in paper, and this is a new program we just began. We began on a trial basis offering state agencies the ability to file rules notices electronically rather than in paper in late 2005. And in 2006, we began to train the agency rule coordinators on the electronic process. Notices filed electronically are more cost-effective and take significantly less time to process, since the information entered online goes directly into our tracking database and into our publication software for publishing. Our ultimate goal is to have a similar process available that will allow for online rule filing online administrative rules filing. But our immediate goal is to increase the number of notices received online rather than in paper. The transition has been fair. About 15% of the agencies filed the rule notices online in 2006. However, and most importantly, what we have learned from this early endeavor is that from our online form, needs to be revised to accommodate the ever-expanding text that agencies are requiring with their rule notices. Our only comparison for a similar process is with other states, and they are all about at the same level we are, as is the very beginning level of allowing this to happen. And the factors that have influenced their early results has been a temporary delay in amending the form since the staff of the publications unit was busy with the publication of the Blue Book, but it is a priority for amending that in 2007.
Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I apologize for coming in late. You may have covered this. I had to testify on another bill. Are you managing the electronic publishing of the rules for all agencies?
Chair Johnson, Senator Johnson, yes, we are.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
I noticed particularly during the interim, envelope after envelope coming to my office with the paper transmittal. Are you getting good cooperation from the agencies to help you get as much of that put electronically as possible?
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, we are. What we have found, though, is our form, because a lot of agencies now, their attorney generals are requiring them to have a very descriptive paragraph on their notices. Our original form did not require that. Was not able to handle that, so we are amending our form so that we will be able to, and then we do anticipate that the rules coordinators will be able to do this and will want to do it, because it is just much more effective to do it that way.
I would assume cost-effective as well.
Very much so.
Those big manila envelopes, and it just seems as the legislature asked to have copies of all of the rules, and they've been very difficult in the early going to interpret, because they would just have runs of ORS numbers, and then the narrative got more extensive. But even at that, I'm trying to estimate the cost of having those sent out, and it has to be substantial.
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, one of the problems is we're still required to publish the bulletin, which is probably what you are receiving, in paper. It's also available electronically. So you don't have to, but we are still required to do it in paper, and we still have a lot of people request it in paper. We have noticed, though, that the total production and publications being ordered in paper have significantly decreased for administrative rules as more and more people are using the online version of our administrative rules.
Thank you.
Okay. Our second performance measure relates to customer service, which is relates directly to Secretary of State's Key Performance Measure 13. The Archives Division has never formally collected customer service feedback. We often get letters from our reference patrons favorably commenting on the services that they've received. And the Records Management Unit Supervisor usually conducts an exit interview with state agencies on records management analyst performance during a retention scheduling process. However, beginning in 2007, each of the Archives Division's program areas will develop and conduct formal surveys asking each of their customer bases to rate the services that they have received, where we need improvement, and what services they would like to include or further develop. Our goal, as always, is outstanding service, although we realize that some customers may not find what they like or are not happy with the advice that we give them, and that may affect our rating. The results of our first surveys will be available at the end of 2007. The next performance measures relate to our program option packages, and the first one is reclassifications, which is our POP 121. Four positions are affected by this program option package. Two of these reclassifications were approved by the 2005 legislature, but were not added to our legislatively approved budget, and these are the Property Specialist 1, reclassified as an Office Specialist 2, and the Editor Assistant to the Electronic Publishing Design Specialist 1. The other two positions that we are asking to reclassify are Principal Exec Manager D to an Operations and Policy Analyst 3, which will reduce the total number of managers from 4 to 3. And then reclassifying the Principal Exec Manager B to a Principal Exec Manager D. These reclassifications are necessary because we have a very large and diverse customer base, and it is imperative that we have the right personnel capable of providing the right service at the right time. Proper classification helps to ensure that this happens.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cromwell, I have a question with regards to the two positions, Principal Executive Manager D to an Operations Policy Analyst, and then a Principal Executive Manager B to a Principal Executive Manager D. Is that going to cause a reduction in your personnel costs, or is this just going to be calling the person a different name but giving them the same salary and basically the same responsibilities?
Chair Jensen, Representative Crummell, I'm not sure what it does to our overall personnel line, but the Principal Exec Manager D never managed people, and it was an improper classification, and we wanted to change that to make it a proper classification. It actually does top out lower than the Principal Exec Manager D. Does the Principal Exec Manager B, when the administrative rule process, that's the manager of the publications unit, and as time has gone on, it's gone from more of a supervisory position to a manager position, and that just reflects the change in that because the person not only manages the publication of the rules but also the publication of the Oregon Blue Book.
So, follow up, if I may, Mr. Chair. So that person that's being changed from a B to a D actually doesn't manage people either. They manage stuff.
Representative Crummell, no, they have a staff of three that they're managing.
In order for us to make a determination on this, I would suggest that it would be important for us to know what kind of a financial effect it has on the division's staffing. And is it going to cause it to go down, or is it going to stay the same or go up? And
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, this package actually has a net cost of $3,591.
Net cost increase?
Yes.
of
$3,591.
Thank you. Senator Thompson.
Thank you. Are these incumbents in positions?
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, yes, they are.
Well, then I have a little trouble with your explanation. Paying them more is going to make them better employees?
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, no, not paying them more, but having them in the proper classification so they can do the entire job that they're required to do.
So they're not doing it now?
No, they are, but they're underclassified. And the other person was basically overclassified. So that's what we just created. We changed their classifications to reflect the job that they are currently doing as opposed to working out of class or working in a class that doesn't match what they're doing.
So one gets to slough off more, and the other one gets to do the same thing. Okay, we're just,
Chair,
is that what we're saying?
No, Chair Jensen, no, absolutely not.
Oh.
it's just in order to make the classifications in our facility, it's very difficult at the Archives Division to work within some of the classifications that we have because of the unique things that we do. And at the time that those positions were assigned, the duties have changed significantly since then, and the reclassifications just reflect those changes in their duties and their responsibilities.
Yes, Representative Edwards.
Thank you. So with the reclassification, is somebody getting a pay cut and somebody's getting a pay raise?
Chair Jensen, Representative Edwards, one is just staying, tops out at a lower level. They're not getting a pay cut. They're staying basically the same, but they won't top out at the same level that they had. Were at the principal exec manager D, they would have topped out higher than at the policy operations analyst. The principal exec manager B was at the top of the classification, so she's just in the middle of the principal exec manager D classification.
So, Mr. Chair, so a B is lower than a D.
Yes.
Okay. So the higher or further you go in the alphabet, the higher the classification.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
You want to be classified as Z.
That's what I'm thinking.
Okay.
Okay. Our second POP relates to a local government position, and it's POP 122. What we are asking for is a local government position and the addition of a position dedicated to providing archives and records management services to local government. And again, it relates to our key performance measure 13, which is customer service. This position is contingent on House Bill 2085 passing, which would add, House Bill 2085 would add a dollar fee to the clerk's recordings, of which 50 cents would stay in the county that is collecting the fee, and the other 50 cents would go to a dedicated fund for local government records programs. This would allow us to hire a position to solely work with local governments and to make the remaining funds available for regranting to counties, cities, and special districts for such projects as improving storage facilities, paying for imaging projects, or electronic records management applications.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
How will you administer that grant program? Based on need, based on per capita, based on...
Okay. Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, the regranting program we have proposed in the legislation, in the proposed House Bill 2085, is a committee would be formed to distribute the funds made up of representatives from the Clerks Association, the Oregon Municipal Recorders Association, and a representative from special districts, along with a representative from the State Archives Division. Cities, counties, special districts would submit an application for a grant for us for a particular project, and the committee would review that grant and then award based on the review of the grants.
Mr. Chair, follow up. What do you see the range of grants being, low to high?
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, it could be as little as $500 for somebody who just wants to purchase boxes and cannot currently afford to buy boxes in their current budget, to being any, you know, $15,000, $20,000 to look at a consultant or get the beginnings of an electronic records management system in place. We are not wanting to cap the limit. There's no amount too small and no amount too big. It will just be based on what we are able to collect and what we'll be able to reward.
Mr. Chair, follow up. I'm just thinking over the counties that I'm familiar with and the special districts and their various abilities to manage and keep records. Why isn't this a local government function? Why is this your function? Why shouldn't AOC provide this advice? I mean, other than the grant mechanism, which ultimately costs the people that are filing, why isn't this a member service of AOC or SDAO?
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, because it's our statutory responsibility to provide this service to local governments, and we currently do it, but we don't have enough resources to help local government out. Local government is probably the neediest when it comes to managing their records. We have storage facilities that are literally semi-tractor trailer boxes sitting in parking lots, to bathrooms and old jail cells where the plumbing is still in place. We right now do a lot of advice and assistance and a lot of training for local governments, and it's very frustrating as somebody who's provided this service for the past 5 years to local governments to have it end there, because that's the limit of our resources.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
You've just made my point, though. How does a $15,000 grant help some little county get their records out of cardboard boxes in the former men's room? I mean, we're talking about huge scale to fix some of this record keeping, and some of it I would submit is pretty deficient. And it's data that is very difficult to manipulate, and I don't mean that in a pejorative sense, but just to use, because it's kept so haphazardly in some cases. How does a granting program that would top out at $15,000 begin to scratch the surface of the need?
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, it's not necessarily top out at $15,000. If that's what they asked for what they want, that's what we felt that was a reasonable process or project, we would do that. If it had topped out at $100,000, we could do that. But what it does is it gives them money, tangible resources, so that they can then go back to their local government entity and get matching funds or help and assistance in doing this. It's something to help the problem, which there is nothing right now to help the problem. In addition, the counties are getting 50 cents on the dollar being collected to go towards their records programs in their counties.
Mr. Chair,
follow.
This is just Monday morning latch on to, you know, working like a dog in an old bone, but I'm just trying to figure out how this all works. How much money are you going to collect?
Chair Jensen and Senator Johnson, we estimate, based on the figures that we got for the recordings that were filed and submitted in 2006, our share for a biennium would be about $1.2 million.
Okay, and so if your share and you're getting half is 1.2, then the counties would get the other 1.2.
Yes.
Is there a restriction that money has to be used on records retention and appropriate archiving?
Yes.
Okay, so you're going to get 1.2 a biennium.
Mm-hmm.
And the locals would match that. And so you really have a granting program of $2.5 million.
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, the 1.2 that the counties get is whatever the individual county collects. So, like, for example, Multnomah County, based on what they recorded, their share of the 50 cents on the dollar would be $124,000. Okay, it would stay in Multnomah County to use on Multnomah County records problems.
Right, and Wheeler County records two documents, so they're going to get
$1.50. Right, but what our hope is because of the money staying within the county, the 50 cents, is that the smaller counties are going to be the ones who are going to come to us and that's for that service.
So how's that going to be fair if Wheeler County never gets enough money to do anything if you require a match? And the reason I'm working on this so hard was that I was in a granting program through the Lewis and Clark Bicentennial, and we had more grief about that because of the ambiguity of the rules. Can a jurisdiction come in with three projects in a cycle? Do they just get one project in a cycle? And I just am very curious as to how you're going to manage this so that the counties that need it the most, and I would submit to you that is not Lane and that is not Multnomah, but the counties that need it the most, that have the crumbling banker's boxes stacked up down in the moldy basement, are the least able to have match to match your program, assuming it's a one-to-one match.
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, it's not a one-to-one match. There is no matching requirement. What our hope is
that... You just told me there was.
No, that we're hoping is that if we give a local government jurisdiction money, then their local jurisdiction may see the value in turning more money, of their money over to that. If it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. Our goal and our hope is to deal with the Wheeler counties, is to give them their grant that they need to manage their records in a most efficient and effective manner. And most likely the Wheeler counties will be getting the larger grants as opposed to the Multnomah counties that aren't going to need it.
Last question, Mr. Chair. Are the rules promulgated yet?
For the
grant program?
No, because we're waiting for the passage of House Bill 2085. The rules for the committee have been established in that it will be representative of local government entities will be the representatives on this, and it will be a re-granting program in that the monies will go back to local governments for their process. But we will form rules, and my concerns are the same concerns that you raise, is that our goal is to help the people who need the most help.
If I were in Multnomah County and the lion's share of the money was raised there or in Lane, I don't know how happy I'd be about subsidizing Wheeler getting their boxes out of the gentleman's room. I just don't understand how that's going to work.
Mr. Chair? As kind of a follow-up to Senator Johnson, we all know that anytime the government comes up with a grant, they come up with an application process that's 487 pages, most of which nobody can read except unless you're an attorney that practices in grant applications. Do you provide help to counties because a small county like Wheeler or Gilliam or some of the others are not going to have the resources necessary. They probably have the expertise, but they don't have the resources to be able to go through all of this application process. So do you offer help to them in terms of getting the paperwork filed so that they can actually take advantage of these grants?
Chair Jensen, Representative Crummell, absolutely. And it won't be a 400-page grant application, because that's the most irritating thing to fill out. I know I have lots of experience doing that, and it really deters you from filing for a grant.
Bingo.
And we're going to encourage people to do this. We really, truly, as I said, prior to becoming a state archivist, I was the records management unit manager, and I have been to every county and probably three-quarters of the cities, and it is really bad. And so that's our goal, is to give them the money that they need to do what they need for their public records.
And follow up, Mr. Chair? One follow up. In regards to the records management, do counties and cities and special districts and all of these different folks look at products that are on, like, for example, a product on the market called Total Recall? That allows for document management and archiving and it's all electronic, but also you can scan the actual documents and those sorts of things. Do they look at those, or is it sort of coming to you as a one-stop shop?
Chair Jensen, Representative Crummell, those products are exorbitantly expensive, and most of them can't afford. They look at them, they like them, but it's too expensive for them to afford. That's one of the reasons why, once we have our electronic records management system in place, we would offer them to buy licenses off of our system, so they wouldn't have to go out and purchase the software and the hardware necessary to manage it. They would just need to pay their licensing fee to buy into our system. Because it really, most of these systems that are out there now that deal with electronic records and document management, you're not going to find anything that's really beneficial in the long run that's going to be under, $50,000 to $100,000. I mean, they're just very, very expensive applications once you implement them totally.
Senator Edwards.
Could you provide me with a couple of examples of how getting the archives out of the men's restroom and the old boxes, how does that provide value to the taxpayers? I mean, you're the archiving guru. I don't know anything about archiving. I'm just here to represent my constituents and make sure that we spend our money wisely, and I'm sure that there are reasons, but I just could you give me a couple of reasons how that provides value?
Okay. Chair Jensen, Representative Edwards, public access is the number one value that you'll get out of having your records in a facility that you can actually know what you have and where it's at, and they're organized in a particular manner. Right now, a lot of times, it's not that counties or local governments don't want to provide access to their records, it's they just can't provide immediate access because they have to go and locate them first and then wade through the facility that they are having them in. In a bathroom or a jail cell, they're usually off-site, so it takes a couple of days to get the public records request made. The other thing is that there are records that they are currently storing that have permanent value to the citizens of Oregon, and maintaining them in a bathroom where the pipes break, the toilets overflow, because they're not decommissioned bathrooms where they take all the plumbing out, they leave all the plumbing in, and we've had a number of instances where the plumbing goes and all of those records get wet and damaged.
So I give me an example of the, I mean, I would assume that the most current and relevant records that would be accessed most often are not kept in these type of facilities, but maybe older records. So what type of records are we talking about? I mean, I understand the part for public access, but public access to what?
Chair Jensen, Representative Edwards, commissioner's records, commissioner's minutes. They are traditionally stored on-site because they are pretty active record, and in a number of local government entities, they are stored in the bathroom.
Thank you.
Okay, our last performance measure relates to another POP, is POP 123, and it's a data center storage study. Currently, the state does not have a facility for the long-term or inactive storage of electronic records. What we have seen is that agencies buy more file servers to maintain records in an active environment and do not have processes for purging records past the retention from their file servers, costing the state a significant amount of money to maintain information that is inactive or past retention in an active environment. The Archives Division operates the State Records Center for paper records that basically meet the same criteria as above electronic records. And the Records Center has saved the state hundreds of thousands of dollars in storage costs because it uses a cost-effective approach to storage and ensures that the records that have met their retention periods are destroyed in a timely manner. This program option package will allow us to hire an independent consultant to locate a facility and recommend the architecture for statewide digital archives / Records Center. And we would like to base the operation and management of this facility on the current and very successful State Records Center. This study would relate to, our key performance measure 13, which is customer service. And we would hope that we would be able to have the facility operational by the 2009-2011 biennium.
Senator Johnson.
What is the fiscal on POP 123?
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, $15,000.
Representative Galizio.
Would the study primarily be about the location, or would it be more about, just kind of the management,
Chair Jensen, Representative Galizio, it would be not only the location, but also the architecture necessary to accommodate both a digital archives and a digital record center. So what systems, hardware, software, servers, that sort of thing that we would need to maintain and manage the facility effectively.
Follow up. So on that element, the architecture, not of the building, but the informational architecture. Other states obviously have probably gone through the same process. They haven't. Okay.
No.
Mr. Chair. Representative Cromwell. I have a little bit of a concern about this. Have you been checking with, let's see, well, it used to be called IRMD, but now it's EISD, EIO, or whatever it is. anyway, McDonald's Farm. Have you checked with them?
Chair Jensen, Representative Crummell, yes, we have. We have talked about this. We've talked with the folks over the data center. We've talked with CIO Council, and we've talked with DAS IRMD all about the proposal for this.
The reason why I asked, Mr. Chair, is because we just spent $100 million building a new data center, and to then go in and the architecture is following on that now. My understanding from the from when we had DAS in here is that the architecture, the digital architecture, is an N architecture type of model, which means you can add modules in and that sort of thing. And to be spending $15,000 on where we're going to put this thing for the record center, I have a real problem with that when we have a building over there that's not completely full, has plenty of space in it, should have also plenty of space as far as file servers and that sort of thing is concerned, because you can use anything from a blade server to a massive one the size of this room. And I would think that as far as storage is concerned and that sort of thing, that facility ought to be the place that the Secretary of State's office looks.
Chair Jensen, Representative Crummell, we have looked at and had that exact same discussion. The one thing is right now the data center is geared towards active storage and not inactive storage, and that would be one of the things we would have to change out, some of the things that are there in order to accommodate it. But that is one of the facilities that has been identified to handle this, and whether that's what we're just looking at, is that the right facility to handle inactive storage of electronic records?
It will take a lot of convincing to convince this legislator that that not going to the data center would be a bad idea, or going to the data center would be a bad idea.
Okay.
Proceed, please.
Okay. Program efficiencies. I'll start with our reference unit. Our reference unit takes advantage of volunteers. In fact, our volunteers for the year of 2006 have given us 1,888 hours of service, which averages almost one full-time employee per month. In fact, we have one volunteer who routinely gives us 20 hours a week, and she's been there for 15 years. We also use student workers and student interns during the summer to help us with a variety of reference projects, including adding names to our name database, genealogical name database, processing records, making them available to the public. We use usually student interns for the more professional programs, and those interns are students who are either enrolled in an archives or records management program or in a public history program. We have allowed, and actually the majority of our requests now come online or in email, and we now have the capability of responding to them totally digitally, in that we can scan the record that they're requesting and then send that back to them through email. It's far faster and a lot more cost-effective to do business that way. 65% of the requests that we get, we answer within 48 hours because we can take advantage of technology as much as we can. Web exhibits, it's very expensive to produce traditional exhibits. Although we do a few of those a year, we can do more and more web exhibits and make them far more interactive and visible to a lot more people because the web reaches a whole different customer base. His genealogical name index has now grown to over 600,000 unique names, and our pioneer index, which I had stated earlier, is at 113,000 names. And these two things in general give us consistently a top 5% ranking in the web presence of the genealogical community. So really, the more we get out on the web, the more people that we can reach with our records, and that's basically going where we're going with our staff.
Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair, as I listen to these very impressive statistics from the archives, I keep reflecting back on the disconnect that we have as a state between being the repository and the storehouse and, frankly, the treasury of all of this important written data. And I think about the state's complete failure to fund or take care of our physical treasures. 100 years ago, we made a deal with the Oregon Historical Society to take care of our tangible history. And we're sitting here today talking about our written history with big investments of money and personnel and time, and that's a good thing. I mean, this is the history of our state. But I just can't help reflect somewhat sadly on the fact that last session, that repository of our tangible history, our treasures, our artifacts, was zeroed out. And I keep wondering, and I'd like to ask you, what would be the net effect if OHS, the Oregon Historical Society, was no longer able to maintain all of those physical treasures, 2 million photographs and Lord knows how many other learned papers and copies of our first constitution? It seems to me that the reasonable place that all that stuff would arrive is on your doorstep. How prepared would archives be to take that over if OHS was unable, given financial constraints, to be able to discharge that basically for free for the state of Oregon? Would you be prepared to handle that?
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, we would be prepared to take it. I mean, it would be a huge endeavor for us to take over. We are not currently equipped to take three-dimensional objects. So photographs is something that we do have an awful large collection of photographs in our holdings, too. So that's something that we have experience in dealing with. It would be huge. It would be very, very demanding and very challenging to do that. But you know, it is a daunting task, and I mean, it's, I don't know, I guess all my years of doing records and public records and that, it's just like records never mean anything to us unless there's a crisis, and that's when it, you know, and that's when we look to manage it, and it's the same with our artifacts, too, is that, as I said, the three-dimensional objects, we are not currently equipped to handle three-dimensional, so I don't know what would happen with those.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
We need four men's bathrooms.
any idea what you do with 300 Indian baskets that need a high degree of curatorial preservation? Any idea what you do with fabrics and sewn artifacts? Any idea what you do with furniture or furs or other treasures like that?
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, no. We just don't have that expertise on our staff to deal with that type of records. Okay, the second unit that I'll talk about, program efficiencies, is our records management unit. And the processes in that unit have been streamlined so that there's only 4 records management analysts can provide advice and assistance as well as current and up-to-date retention schedules to the many state agencies and political subdivisions. This year alone, we did a new general schedule for school districts, and ESDs, educational service districts, which serves in and of itself hundreds and hundreds of government entities and gives them an up-to-date retention schedule. We have standardized our training programs so that any member of our staff can go out and give these workshops to state and local government entities. Again, web-based training is big for us because we can get more out to more people. And our latest ones, I mean, has been the local government email management web-based video and manual. And with all of our web-based training applications, we do try to make them interactive and include a manual and templates with them so that it's not only a workshop to learn, but you have tools to take with you and use. We have established a great cooperative approach with the Oregon Association of Municipal Recorders to help them produce some of these web-based applications. And we've also worked with them at the request of the International Institute of Municipal Clerks to develop a training program for their basic certification program for basic records management. And then we've also developed our file structure approach for the effective management of electronic records so that when we implement our electronic records management system, it will be the foundation is already there to overlay that system and make it the most effective. The State Record Center, with its two full-time employees, they manage over 80,000 boxes, and their processes are streamlined so that 100% of the agency's file requests are not only answered within 24 hours of the request, but they can now accommodate a request that comes in at 1 o'clock and get it on the 1:30 shuttle out for delivery that same day. So a lot of agencies within Salem are getting their records requests answered within 4 hours. And we use databases to manage and track our inventory, and that's what makes us so cost-effective. All of their forms and procedures are online, so state agency personnel knows exactly what to do and where to go to get the information they need to send their boxes to the State Records Center. The Security Copy Depository, we have one full-time employee that manages 250,000 reels of microfilm. And because of our streamlined process and effective use of databases, they can fulfill the request for film within 24 hours of receipt. We require every roll of microfilm that comes into our depository to be inspected to see if it complies with our standards. And that is done within the first 48 hours of receipt because we want any problems with the film identified before the original record is destroyed. What the Security Copy Depository does is ensures that all of our information that has long-term historical value is preserved in a manner that can be retained for over 500 years, and it doesn't matter what it's created on now. Microfilm can be made from that record, whether it's digital or paper, and then it's preserved for the length of time it needs to be done. Our publications unit, we have the online rule notice filings, and so despite the fact that more rules are being filed, we have not needed to request any additional positions. We've gone to doing our own free distribution of the Blue Book. When the Department of Administrative Services, they used to do the free distribution, but they raised their prices to do this, so we took it in-house, and not only did we see a cost savings, but we got the books out in a more in a quicker turnaround time period, and we used two students to do that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
I would just like to use this public forum as a chance to applaud your whole organization, because I know it starts from the top all the way down through the guys that are distributing the Blue Book for the publication of the Blue Book. I think it's a remarkable document, and through the generosity of the Secretary of State's office, I had the chance to help him dispose of some of the old out-of-date books by putting them into the hands of some high school kids who were actually thrilled to have them. And even though they're slightly dated, they still carry such valuable information about the state. The historical perspective, a copy of the Constitution. It's a remarkable publication, and I don't know how many other states produce a book like that, but as Oregonians, we all ought to be very proud of that.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. In going with the Blue Book, touching on the old, outdated Blue Books, we started a program last biennium in which we do take those older Blue Books and we offered them to schools for free, so that they can be used as textbooks in the classrooms. And the response to this has been absolutely overwhelming. During the summer, we have teachers coming in daily to pick up boxes of Blue Books to distribute and use in their classrooms. We have been able to reduce the number of Blue Books printed due to the ever-growing popularity of the online Blue Book, which continues to contain more and more information that's again, much. We find that teachers are now starting to use that as a teaching tool in their Oregon history and government classes. So the Blue Book has been very successful for our program. The efficiencies in relates to our program option packages, the reclassifications, we just feel that a properly classified staff will help us to be more competent and thus more cost-effective and more efficient. Our local government position, again, it allows us to a focused approach to local government records, and with hopefully the passage of our bill will give us the monetary resources to help ensure that public records at the local level are protected and accessible. And finally, the data storage. Eventually, this will lead to a more cost-effective approach to managing and storing electronic records. And that's all that I have. And thank you for the opportunity.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your presentation for us this morning. Very helpful and informative for us. Any concluding questions? I guess not. Thank you again,
Mr.
Chair. At this point, we have the Audits Division.
I'd like to introduce to you Chuck Hibner, who's the state auditor. He started with the audits division in 1995 and started as an entry-level auditor and has worked through the ranks and is now the state's auditor. And he serves on the National State Auditors Association, both as a member and as a committee vice chair. And he's soon to be a board member of the Pacific Northwest Intergovernmental Audit Forum. So, pleasure to introduce him.
Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Jensen, members of the committee. For the record, Chuck Hibner, Director of the Audits Division. My presentation is, when I timed it at home, it was about a half an hour. You want me to just kind of get started and we'll see where we're going.
Okay. Until these people start interrupting.
I wouldn't anticipate that. Just to give you a brief description of what it is we do, we are the only independent audit organization in the state with the duty and authority to audit all three branches of state government. We do that by providing several types of services. They are audits. We do audits. Every year we perform the annual opinion audits for the state. We also do discrete opinion audits for several agencies within the state that do have requirements for having opinion audits. Also, as a part of our annual reviews, we do the compliance part for both our ability to receive federal funds. The feds require certain activities of us when we do the federal compliance, and also as a part of our other work, we do compliance with other significant rules and state laws. We also do performance audits and information technology audits, both performed under the standards appropriate for performance audits and information technology, and information technology audits also are performed under standards for information technology, so they actually have to comply with two sets of standards. And we also do investigations, both as a part of our hotline work, which we are the we do manage the hotline, and also other discrete requests for investigative work. So we do have several certified fraud examiners on our staff. We do this work with 68 professional staff, 72 staff overall. Our staff are cross-trained so that we're able to dedicate resources to the activities of the moment. Our job, our work is cyclical. Our financial audit work typically starts beginning in the summer and will wind down as the year-end approaches, though we still do work year-round, but certainly not as much. And that allows us, by having folks cross-trained, we're able to provide staff to do different types of work in the spring and then also do the financial audit work, which is about 60% of what we do during the peak of that season. We also do manage the government waste hotline. In 1995, that law was passed, and we've continued to manage that function. We also provide information and consultative services. We provide letters of assurance where they're where deemed necessary. We have what's called our bond letter division, where we will produce several discrete products for providing those letters of assurance for bonds that are issued within the state. We also provide consulting and education services for agencies and some of the municipal CPAs and local official and others. And then, of course, legislative testimony. When we do release reports, oftentimes we're asked to come in and explain our results. We also provide testimony in front of the Joint Legislative Audit Committee on a regular basis, and both to tell them what we're up to and what we'd like to do, and also oftentimes to provide testimony on reports that we have issued. We also have one regulatory function in that we do provide oversight for the municipal audit law, which, though we don't do municipal audits of those municipalities, we do oversee the program and provide oversight for those local municipal auditors that are providing that service for the state and for those opinion audits. In terms of our budget, primarily our budget request is just asking for funds enough to continue our activities, other than the one program option package where we are specifically asking for additional resources to do K through 12 audits, provided a bill passes, there will be that we're hoping to get dedicated resources to carry out that sort of responsibility. Other than that, we're really just asking for enough funds to continue the sort of activities I've described before. As far as our budget drivers, we've on page 3.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. I guess I'll be the first one to throw you off, but I actually just had an email at the end of last week from someone wanting to know where they can find out about audits and find information about audits. So is everything on your accessible through your website?
Chair Jensen, Representative Beiner, I would say most of what we do, we do whenever we issue a formal audit report or a management letter, we do post that to our website. So if they're interested in a specific product that we have produced, it should be available on the website.
And how long do you usually keep an audit on the website?
Chair Jensen, Representative Beiner, they stay on indefinitely. Since we started the website, we have not taken anything off, so we're continuing to accumulate. I don't know when critical mass will be hit, and we'll have to start pulling stuff off, but at this point, we haven't pulled anything off.
Thank you.
As far as our budget drivers, we've listed several bullets. I think I've got 5 bullets here. One would be the auditing and accounting standards that have been promulgated over the last few years. We continue to see more and more auditing standards being issued as a result of the scandals. They even produced another body to put out even more accounting standards, and they really are focusing on auditing and getting auditors to really consider risk, document risk, and so that has come down to us. It has been in the private sector primarily, but we're starting to feel it more and more in the government sector. And in order to respond to those things, that is requiring more of our audit resources to document those sorts of things in a reasonable way. The second bullet, audit mandates, is something we're always aware of. We have had several audit mandates that do require are in statute that require our attention, the hotline being one example. Measure 66 was actually a constitutional mandate that required us to go out and look at the expenditures of those lottery funds on environmental sort of activities and ensuring they're compliant with the intent of that law. And then, of course, there are others. But we're always aware of, and when a new law comes through without a dedication of additional resources, of course, we're taking what would be considered discretionary resources, things we may be doing on IT or investigations or performance audits, and handling this new set of requirements. Not that it's necessarily a bad thing. We just like to enter into that discussion to make sure that trade-off is what folks are really interested in. Technology, of course, is another thing that we consider a budget driver, both and a challenge. As new technologies are introduced, we are constantly looking for ways to use those things to become more efficient ourselves. But they also provide a challenge as auditors of information technology, in that we need to understand it in a way that will allow us to go out and do meaningful audit work. So we're constantly involved in training and trying to understand what the implications of those new technologies might be, so we can provide, again, some meaningful audit work on anything that we need to be doing. Cost of contracted services is another bullet item here, this is a major part of our strategy. Since we are in a situation where we have limited internal resources, we're constantly trying to grow our staff, utilizing contractors to do some of our opinion audit work and the federal compliance work has become something we do regularly. Those costs have continued to go up. They're subject to the same sorts of auditing standards and accounting standards as we are. So their costs go up, and hence our costs go up.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Could you give us a flavor for what kind of contracted services and how you make it known out in the marketplace that you're looking for? I presume these are private sector services.
Correct. Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, we do post it on our website, and we do have a list of qualified folks to do that, to provide services. Our universe of auditors tends to be fairly small. Most of the people who who tend to bid on our services tend to bid on it regularly. We certainly are always trying to get more people to come and bid on our services. Competition, you know, provides us assurance that we're getting the best value. But we do follow the similar process to most state contracts, where they're posted. We contact folks, let them know that either a request for qualifications or a request for proposals out there, and solicit it in that manner.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
You said something intriguing, qualified vendors. And the reason that I am curious to ask you to amplify on that, and let me set the context for you, is that in other agencies where there are lists of vendors, and let me take something that's very complicated and very controversial, that's wetland delineations. Mm-hmm. I have been told that other agencies are not able to provide a list of qualified vendors because somehow that would be perceived as discriminatory or not open to all comers. How do you maintain a list of qualified vendors, and how do you define that?
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, I would recommend for amplification when we get our business services folks in here, they give you the specifics. But the sort of qualifications that we're looking for are folks that can provide audit services that are compliant with the auditing standards that we will be requiring, like Yellow Book standards, those sorts of things. They need to be able to document that they can provide an audit service, an audit report that meets those sorts of standards. So in our request for qualification, we'll ask those sorts of questions. Are your staff certified? Do you maintain training in the same measure that you need to in order to meet standards? Those sorts of things, to make sure that we're getting folks that at the end of the day can provide us a audit report or a management letter that meets the sort of standards that we're asking. So we do, it's two-faced, yeah.
That's very helpful. I colleagues would submit to you that that's a practice that we might want to see employed across more of state government, to have lists of minimum qualifications to be able to provide services or to allow an agency to recommend a consulting firm. It's been my experience that if you don't have some kind of ability to set minimum qualifications, you end up in some cases with some pretty substandard products. And I think what you're doing is completely appropriate. You've got to have a minimum degree of competency to provide the complicated audits that you're doing.
Exactly. Thank you. But
thank you, Chair Jensen. Mr. Hibner, we've talked about this before, but you know, I have a major concern about the lack of auditing capacity of many of the nonprofits that receive grants in the state. And we have a tendency to provide them with large chunks of money and suggest to go forth and do good things, and then assume that they're going to. And most of them do, and I think it's a great way to leverage state funds.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that we need some more oversight in that, and the question is, do you currently, you've indicated that you do have statutory and constitutional authority to audit these, even and not only audit them from the standpoint of state funds, but also commingled other sources of private funds. Do you have the current capacity to do a good job of auditing those on request? And if not, what would it take?
Chair Jensen, Senator Whitsitt, again, that's an intriguing question because I do share your interest and concern with the money we do pass through to both nonprofits and local governments who do spend a significant amount of such things as lottery funds and those sorts of things without our oversight. I mean, not that they probably need it to feel that they spend the money well, but we do have an interest in that. I don't believe that we would have the capacity to undertake that in a large way. The challenge has always been with pass-through funds is that the funding for any of our audit work is an issue. We're dealing with that now with the K-12, where we have the statutory authority to do the audit work, to audit state funds wherever they may go, but at the end of the day, we'll be having to send the auditee the bill. It's not funded through the assessment. So we have had moments in the past where we've sent the bill and it hasn't worked out in everybody's favor. So we've tried other approaches to try to get things lined up so that it's a meaningful and as pleasant as possible an experience as we can have. I know that when we talked about doing the pass-through, I didn't have an answer for you in terms of how to fund our activities if it's not going to be directly paid for by the pass-through entity that receives the funds. In giving it some thought, potentially, I guess you could add a provision to each funding bill that would pay for any audit activities out of the dedicated fund, pay for it out of the lottery funds before it goes to the counties, and that would give us an opportunity to send the bills there. And not necessarily to the local entity, but maybe this is a discussion we should have offline if it's something you'd like to talk about more.
Thank you. Thank you,
Jack. Again, contracted audit services, we utilize those primarily for some of our larger opinion audits and then for our federal compliance work. Their costs are going up, as are ours. Staff retention is probably not just the biggest budget driver, but probably the biggest challenge that has faced our organization for quite some time. We are only as good as our audit staff. We're an organization of professionals, and the better we are, the better our products are, both in terms of efficiency I guess in terms of efficiency, getting what we need to get done in a quick and meaningful way. And we have had substantial turnover during the last few biennia. So it's something that we continue to focus on. As you'll be able to see from our budget, professional services is probably one of our largest item, if not the largest item, on our budget. And we've done some things to try to improve the staff retention in our own salary matrix. So we've changed things a little bit. We are seeing some benefit from that. I think I noted in the budget that we're actually being able to retain staff in a more meaningful way. We're seeing our seniority numbers climb a little bit, so we're getting folks to stick around a little longer. But we're still losing people to the private sector. Even though we did adjust salaries and we're in a position now where we're competitive, during this last year, we've lost two to a fairly significant private sector firm. And I think that no matter what we do, I think some of that is going to happen. But we are managing to retain those people, our more senior people, our audit managers, and our senior folks that manage these audits for us. And we're seeing numbers improve, seeing the seniority numbers improve. So I think the things that we're able to do are having an effect. But that really is probably our primary mission as managers for this agency, is to try to continue to develop our staff and then keep them.
Mr. Chair.
This same committee has heard testimony from other, I'm trying to think what to call it, not only agency, but I won't be cute about it, the Treasurer's Office, in talking about their ability to try to keep and retain people working in a very competitive environment. And I'm just wondering, a different model has been adopted for the Treasurer's Office wherein bonuses are paid in order to retain and attract key people. And I don't know whether or not that's a model that you've given any thought to, given all the strictures now that face the audit community and all of the complexities that have been piled on by federal action, and the huge liability for individual auditors to perform at a high level, whether or not you've looked at that bonus model as a way to perhaps attract and retain key people in your section.
Chair Jensen, Senator Johnson, I've been involved in those discussions. We haven't, during my year as director, we haven't specifically looked at that as an option. But when the former director, Kathy Polina, was here and we were trying to decide what we needed to do to try to make this thing work well, I know that sort of discussion was out there. At the time when everyone was trying to hold the line on salaries and we weren't even allowed to have increases, you know, merit increases during that one salary freeze, we were looking at other things to do. It certainly would be something that, if it was available to us, it would be something that would be that would mirror what's happening in the private sector. I know that bonuses are paid in the private sector. That being said, the reason a lot of folks come to work for us isn't for pay. It isn't their number one priority, but it isn't their number 10 either. So and we understand that. But you know, as long as we can compensate them fairly and give them some of the quality of life that you do get as working for the state. You're not working 75-hour weeks. You're working your 40, 45, maybe 50 during the busy times, and have a life outside. I think we can compete, but certainly anything of that nature that allows us to have a little more flexibility and possibly offer that one thing that would make a huge difference, I would certainly entertain. And now that you bring it back up, I'll probably be considering it in a more meaningful way.
I'm curious. Do you have a per hour figure for your audit or auditors? When you're doing an audit, what are your dollar figures for doing it?
Yeah, Chair Jensen, one of our performance measures actually gets to that in some way. If our first performance measure, we do list our billing rate as compared to private sector billing rate. And for the last biennium, we had $69 per audit hour, where the private sector figure was $123. Going into this next biennium, I would expect it to increase. We did do some salary increases, and as I state in the performance measure, we have a very young staff still, and as they mature and hopefully stick around and we're able to continue to move them along, then it will, our rate will continue to increase. I think that's my hope. You don't often hope that your rate increases, but you know, if we're doing things right and keeping people around longer, it will continue to increase. So I think that our rate at the moment is probably artificially depressed because we've got some fairly young staff as well as some people with some senior status, but we still have a lot of young folks. Okay. Well, I was going to get into the performance measures, so we've just kind of talked about performance measure number one, which...
Looks like we're going to ask you to come back tomorrow if
it's
you
fine.
Can.
You bet.
And can we just use that as a point then?
We'll start with performance measures.
Start with the performance measures tomorrow. One of the, a couple of other questions. You make a statement in your here on audit mandates, a number of audits required by law through legislation or ballot measures has increased significantly over the past few years. And can you expand on what you mean, what you're saying here? I mean, I understand what the words are, but what actually is going on?
Chair Jensen, over the last several years, I wouldn't say that this past year last year or two was as significant as in the past, but over the last few bienniums, such things as the Measure 66, constitutional amendment that required us to do some auditing of the lottery funds that were passed through to parks and other natural resources agencies, that certainly was something that was mandated for us to do. Prior to that, there was Senate Bill 1, which required us to look at the Oregon Youth Authority and decide whether they were doing a good job, I guess, in rehabilitating young offenders. And then such things as... what else did I list? Oh, the hotline. I mean, when we were given the hotline function, that was in 95. That was one of those mandates that takes resources for us to do.
Go back to the Oregon Youth Authority. Enlighten me on what your audit finds with that. I'm finding it strange that it would be an auditor that would be doing an assessment or evaluation of the efficiency or effectiveness of a program of that nature. And don't misunderstand me, this is not in any way meant to be disparaging as far as auditors are concerned, but I I would not look to an auditor to provide this kind of information for me.
Chair Jensen, I wouldn't disagree with you. That has been one of the challenges for us with this mandate in the Senate Bill 1 bill, is that the bill is contemplating having a decision reached, an opinion on whether things are working well. The sort of work we have done on this issue has been more around, is the information being provided to people who can make those sorts of decisions. So it's been a little bit contrary for us.
The idea of assessing the effectiveness of legislation we have, I think, is meritorious on the part of the legislature to do that, because hopefully if it isn't being effective, we'll be smart enough to do away with it or change it significantly. I'm not sure that takes place. Seems to me that all too often things kind of have an energy of their own, and regardless of how good a job they're doing, just kind of keep going forward. And I was just curious, with this. The reason I'm curious here is one of the things that's been bothering me is the unfunded mandates that unintentional, sometimes just plain unfunded mandates that come out. And this is especially true in the ballot measures, where we have sometimes some huge unfunded mandates that come down to us. And, of course, the people sitting around a table like this are the ones that have to figure out how we're going to pay for those unfunded mandates, and sometimes those costs are huge. And I give us one simple example, the ballot measure 11 costs that we've had as far as the state is concerned. No discussion about the merits of ballot measure 11 or anything of that nature, just the costs that have come been passed on to us. And how we as a legislature, as a body, can kind of come to deal with that, since contrary to a lot of opinion, we don't have a blank check that we can we don't print money in Salem like they do in Washington, and as a consequence, when we take from A to give to B, as in B being an unfunded mandate, A goes without, such an area that's been a major concern to me, not necessarily a concern of this committee. So that was my reason for the questioning on this. Appreciate your answers. Is there any other questions before we
Mr. Chair?
Representative Crumlin.
I have two questions, and actually if they want to bring the answers back tomorrow, that would be just fine. The first one is, when you are legislatively mandated to do an audit, who is the client? And the second one is that what audit functions are legislatively created?
Okay.
That's it.
Okay.
For now.
I'm just wondering on your first question. Legislative mandate, aren't we the legislature the client?
And that's an interesting question, Mr. Chair. And the reason why I ask that question is because there are places in statute where we have given the audits division the authority to do the audits and asked them to do specific audits. And when we try to get the information back from them, we are told that we are not the client. Therefore, the agency has to have the opportunity to respond, because it's the agency that is the client. If we as a legislature have asked the audits division or told the audits division to do an audit, I would argue that we are the client and we ought to be privy to the information as it's going through the process. But that is not the case. And so I want it on the record as far as who the client is when we legislatively mandate an audit be done. And then that also goes into the other question, because there are certain functions that are described in the Constitution, and the other functions are actually legislatively created.
Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll see you again
tomorrow morning.
Tomorrow morning.
Okay.
Thank you.
One more fun and games.